Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Can I take you out to the pictures?
Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movies.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello, and welcome back to the Beatles Films Podcast. I'm Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
We're both professional film writers and Fab Four fans, and we're back for another season, each week discussing a different movie about, starring, or inspired by the Beatles. And to celebrate making it to season three, we're kicking off this new run of episodes with the one film I couldn't wait to cover since all the way back from when we first conceived the idea of the podcast. That's right, it's finally time to discuss 1984's Give My Regards to Broad Street, a musical drama written by, scored by, produced by, and starring Paul McCartney. So a bit of context for this film and why I'm so giddy with excitement and why I can't wait to dig into it is that while the soundtrack to the movie topped the UK album charts at the time of release and it produced a single, No More Lonely Nights, that was nominated for both a Golden Globe and a BAFTA, the film itself is universally panned. It was such a critical and commercial flop that who's to say whether or not actually it directly led to just 2 years later, Broad Street Station itself closed down. The first question to ask, or the first thing to sort of really dig into, is what is it about this film that doesn't quite work? And I think that the obvious thing to point out is not much plot.
Yeah.
Really not much plot.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The entire premise of the film is Paul McCartney, playing basically Paul McCartney, has the master tapes for his new album go missing. And they were last seen with an employee of his who has a sketchy criminal past. And that's it. That's it. There's no sort of really tracking down of the tapes. There's just Paul McCartney playing some songs and being left to wonder and imagine and daydream and fantasize about what may have happened to those tapes. That's right. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. It's an odd thing to do. Like, as an auteur piece...
Okay.
I mean,
going straight into that, are we?
Yeah, but like, fair enough. Like, by definition, this is an auteur piece.
You sure?
but think about it's a strange thing to do to want to write and star in your own film that is kind of all about you. you would think it would be more of a sort of hero fantasy. You know, it suggests a certain ego or a certain self-aggrandizement. And obviously, I don't think Paul is free of those things by any stretch. But what a strange thing to do, to write a film in which you are the center of it, but everything just sort of goes on around you. You know,
you
don't particularly initiate anything happening. Like, you're told that there's a big problem, and the people who work for you say, well, this is a really big deal, we need to fix this. And you go, yeah, okay, I'll just be in the studio, let me know what happens.
I mean, and so this is just, that's really it, because first of all, there are no stakes as far as Paul's concerned in the movie. At no point does he seem particularly overly worried about his tapes going missing.
No.
At any point. And otherwise, we're just experiencing what is supposed to be a typical day in the life of Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
As, by the way, within the first 5 minutes, literally scheduled out and laid out by his 80s car robot.
Yeah. Yeah.
9:30 meeting. Yeah. Studio time, rehearsal, interview. It basically gives us, the car robot gives us a breakdown of all the movie beats that are coming up.
Yeah, yeah.
But at no point during any of that does he feel any sense of urgency to track down these tapes. He's just carrying on about his day and just kind of gently wondering what happened to them.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he doesn't seem to mind too much, does he? And also, it's very easy to think of this as a big ego piece, and it is, you know, far from free of ego. But at the same time, it seems like so hubristic, and obviously the way that it turned out, you know, is sort of famously critically panned, and seems to have the critical reception of it seems to have stung him enough that he just sort of it hid away a bit for the rest of the 80s. You know, he didn't really, you know, he didn't tour again until the Flowers in the Dirt tour. I wonder if it reminded him a bit of Magical Mystery Tour, you know, that first kind of critical panning, in which he was quite defensive. Like, you know, we discussed Magical Mystery Tour, and he went on TV to talk to David Frost a day or two later. And was defending it, you know, on the basis of, no, I think, you know, these are valid artistic choices. And the sort of the accompanying South Bank show in which Melvyn Bragg is interviewing Paul in 1984, which people should seek out on YouTube because it's fascinating.
It is amazing, yeah.
Melvyn Bragg is actually challenging him a little bit about some of his creative choices, you know, and it's he's kind of slightly defensive about that as well. But it's interesting that, like, the last time he had creative freedom over a film, which he largely did with Magical Mystery Tour. I know it wasn't, you know, he was sort of more the director of it than any of the other Beatles.
Well, he wrote the script as well.
The script, yes.
He wrote The Circle.
He wrote The Circle, yeah. It was kind of critically panned, but I think he was quite pleased with the results. So it's interesting that this project, the stakes are probably a bit higher. And he seems to go into it with a very similar attitude. He treats it quite casually, as we understand it. The script he turned in for it was 22 pages long. The movie script
is really large font.
Movie scripts in general, the general rule of thumb is that there'll be a sort of one page per minute. So, you know, 90-minute film, 90-page script. So 22 minutes, and I think there was quite a lot of bits where he'd filled in just going, oh, and then, you know, to get from here to here, we'll just sort of make bits up, or, like, you know, song here, or something
music,
like that.
Music, what he says in the South Bank show, is that he had music 1 to 10, and he'd say music 1 here, music 2 here.
Yeah.
Which says to me two things. It says that he wasn't choosing music or design in the film for the music to actually relay anything that was relevant to the plot at the time.
No.
But also, as evident in the film later on, when you see it, none of those musical choices actually drive the plot forward at all. Like, no. The film comes to an absolute standstill every single time they start playing a song. And sometimes those are two or three songs in a row. So there were just a segment of 10 to 15 minutes where there isn't any plot and you're just watching him perform songs.
Yeah.
Which arguably isn't a bad thing, but also isn't necessarily conducive to a compelling drama.
No, that's true. the sort of artistic choices he's made are very much those of a man who's just completely confident that anything he does will be great. And and the normal rules of how to do things don't apply to him, even when he's stepping into a medium in which he's not expert. He can be forgiven for being completely confident in that, like, when I'm writing and recording music, my choices are good ones, you know. Even if other people aren't quite so sure, I'll be like, no, I know what I'm doing. Generally speaking, he will be proved right. But he seems to take the same approach into film, in which he doesn't have a track record. I think that's kind of where the hubris is, because the idea of, even though it's his own production company, you know, so this is MPL going in, you know, sort of financing the film to the tune of $500,000, and it is initially going to be a sort of 1-hour TV movie. And they get a TV director in called Peter
Webb.
TV commercial director in.
I feel like that's an important point to make. Commercial director who, and again, probably another important point to make, never made another film after this one.
No, that is true. That may well be significant. so they get the TV commercial director, Peter Webb, who is well suited to the sort of TV project that it starts out being. And it's sort of more acceptable, I suppose, the fact that he has to work in a very informal, ramshackle, shoestring kind of a way with this sort of non-script that Paul has turned in. Like, it hasn't gone through any sort of rewrites or any edits. It's, you know, all the holes in it are ones that the director is kind of expected to fill. Now, that's one thing when you're working on a 1-hour TV project. What happens then is that it ends up with Harvey Weinstein, who is the head of Miramax, who then takes it to 20th Century Fox, who then puts in, I think, about £4 million worth of budget. And because they think this is going to be a sort of, you know, this is 20 years after A Hard Day's Night, they're probably thinking, like, Ringo's in it as well, this is a Beatle reunion, you know, we can sell this. They haven't seen the script or anything like that. They just go for it. And so all of a sudden it becomes a very different thing. And so I suppose it's when you're more or less self-financing something, you can imagine the original version of this as originally envisaged as a TV thing with a £500,000 budget. It's not the worst thing in the world to approach that a bit like you did Magical Mystery Tour.
Sure.
But then when it becomes something else, maybe you need to start taking it a bit more seriously.
Yes, yeah. You
know, maybe get someone to have a look at the script.
Yes, like, yeah. What little of it there is. I love the idea that the full script that he wrote for this was 22 pages long. I feel like a lot of people say, I've written a film script. And what they mean is they've got an idea for a film script, but they haven't actually just got around to committing pen to paper yet.
Yeah.
And there's a reason why they haven't done that, because actually their idea for a film script is no more than an actual premise. And the problem with actually writing the script is you have to think about things like subplots and character development, none of which is present in this film. So I kind of feel like Paul has done the thing of saying, I've written a film script and has just stuck to the bare basic bones of what that idea is and not really developed it anywhere beyond that initial thought into a full script.
Yeah.
To the extent that when he's in that South Bank show, he talks about how, you know, he wants to be involved in films. He was looking at scripts that might interest him. And then one day he was stuck in a traffic jam and decided that he was just going to start writing.
Yeah.
And what I love about that is the film starts with him stuck in a traffic jam writing.
Yeah.
So you can just imagine that he's in a traffic jam writing. And it's like, what should I write about?
Yeah.
Let's write what you know.
But you see, that's the interesting thing. It's not, you know, it's not just, it's easy to look at and think, well, this is a big star and nobody said no to him. And, you know, and this is what happens when, like, big stars have, like, bad ideas or even good ideas that just need finessing, but they don't listen to anyone else and everyone says yes to them. You know, it's tempting to think that's the case, but it doesn't seem to be, because also, like, in 1984, Paul McCartney is not the biggest star in the world. You know, it's not, it's... The fact that Miramax came over, you know, and Fox came and pumped a load of money into it, in fairness to him, it's not particularly his fault, it seems.
Yeah,
it just seems to have, like, gone that way. And the whole thing, like, became something quite different. But yeah, I think the whole thing of like him sitting in the back of the car, which is a framing device for the whole film.
Yep.
Can we get into talking about the story? I mean,
yeah, I feel like we'd already covered it, aren't you? I thought it was done. And done. But yeah, sure. Okay, let's dig into those few words a bit more.
So, what happens at the start is Paul is sitting in the back of a chauffeur-driven car. To introduce him, the camera pans up from his boat shoe. because and I like the fact that the camera like lingers on his boat shoe a little bit before panning up his leg to show, oh, this is Paul McCartney. But I like the fact that it's the way that you introduce a character to say, oh, this is a man of wealth and taste. He has boat shoes and everything. and he's there, and so he is sort of writing on a pad. He seems to be writing lyrics at something, and then he taps his pen in the air as if he's had an idea. And on the radio, it's the DJ said something like, going back to the summer of 1966.
It's raining outside. So it's pouring down with rain outside. Yeah. And he's just saying it like, take you back to the sunny days of 1966.
That's it, yeah. And they play Good Day Sunshine.
Yep.
Which is the re-recorded version. It sounds very, very similar to the original.
Yeah, like indistinguishable, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And that makes him drift off into a reverie, a sort of daydream. And the daydream is initially that he is driving a very fast car, and he's got his, as you say, the computer that tells him, you know, like a ZX Spectrum, basically, that tells him, you know, what his day is going to be. So the interesting thing about this as a conceit is that it's Paul McCartney daydreaming about having a more exciting life than being Paul McCartney. But it introduces the idea that there are bits about being Paul McCartney that are quite mundane, you know, like sitting in a chauffeur-driven limo, writing in your pad. But also, what happened, because then later on at the end, because the entire rest of the story, other than the last 2 minutes or so, turn out to be what he's been daydreaming.
Yes.
The ending is sort of often criticized for being a, and it was all a dream ending. But in fairness to him, and like this is one of the few things I'll defend about this.
I'm listening.
He has flagged that right from the start. There are a few possible approaches, creative approaches that he's taken to this framing device, all of which are quite interesting, I think.
Right.
So is it that he wants you to forget that he is daydreaming? Paul McCartney, the writer of the film, wants you to forget that Paul McCartney, the character, is having a daydream, so that later on it is a satisfying reveal that this was all a dream. Because you saw so little of it at the start that you've forgotten it.
I'm going to say yes.
Okay.
But let's hear your other options.
Or is it not supposed to be a twist? Like, does he want you to know that he's dreaming it all the way through? And he thinks that this has satisfactorily achieved that aim.
So if I were to give Paul McCartney, the screenwriter of this film, credit that I don't necessarily think is due.
Right. No. Okay.
I would say that it's a very good thing that the very first instance of Paul McCartney's daydream is an obvious daydream where he is basically racing a car along a country path, and it's all sped up and it looks like a fantasy. So it's very clearly earmarked as a cartoonish.
Yeah.
So when that part of it ends, you would, as an audience, you are forgiven for thinking you're back to reality now.
Mm.
And then the ending where it's revealed that it's all been a daydream is actually still a twist, because you have been fooled into thinking that it was only that first part that was a twist.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah.
I don't know whether Paul McCartney, the screenwriter of this film, has approached his 22-page script with that deceit in mind.
No, right, yeah. No, it's fair to say he hasn't approached it with that much rigour. But then sort of at the end, when he sort of wakes up and says, he's been daydreaming. So he's interrupted by his manager, Steve, Australian, played by Brian Brown. And And Steve reveals that the character Harry, who has been the sort of main driver, if you like, of the daydream narrative, is an actual person that exists in the life of this Paul McCartney.
Yes.
So it's not that he has dreamed a thing where there's this imaginary guy who works for him.
No.
Who everyone thinks has stolen the tapes, but Paul is convinced hasn't. It's not that he's made up that bit. It's that there is a guy who works for him in real life.
Yeah.
And he's made up a story in which that guy is accused of stealing things. And Paul, because he's really nice.
Yeah.
Is the only one who defends him because yes. And like the character of Paul he's very, very keen to point out, and it happens a lot throughout the story, where he's saying, no, Harry's a good guy. I just don't think he'd do this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I believe him.
Exactly.
And he's like, we've in a space of a day, we've judged him, we've found him guilty, and we've sentenced him.
Right, right.
It's like, I don't think we've got... At the point he says that, it's like, I think you've just judged him. I don't think you know the other two, but right, sure.
I don't think you really understand the British legal system. Paul,
no, to be honest, at all, like, yeah. You know. When has he ever had to?
No, true.
But it's interesting you say that because I agree. So when at the point at which Brian Brown's character Steve says, Harry's here, like he's all fine. In my mind, I'm thinking, how close does the real life Harry in that part of the story resemble the daydream Harry?
Mm.
Like, does the real life Harry have a criminal background?
Right.
In which case, you could argue that Paul's daydream is about his own paranoia bias around having hired someone with that and the fears that might bring with bringing someone like that into his like sort of personal fold. Or he doesn't, and Paul McCartney just thinks he's a bit shifty, so then daydreams this entire criminal past and conjures up quite a detailed backstory.
Yeah, with like Tracy Ullman as the guy's girlfriend and everything, who's always hanging around looking glum.
Yeah.
And Paul just like inexplicably takes her for a drive in a van. And then there's a car chase which sort of goes nowhere.
Yeah.
And so like they're being chased in this van. And it ends with them just parking the van, the people who were chasing them just stopping behind them.
Yeah.
And that's that.
That's it. Yeah.
Like, you know, it's not like they were trying to kill them or anything. It's just that. And then I think he like says to Tracy Ullman, like, okay, I've just got to go to rehearsal now. I'll see you later.
Yeah.
where is any of this going? Where did you think this was going? Like, but the interesting thing is actually in the writing of it, there is what is so conspicuous to me is there are so many dead ends, but also just so much dead space in the scenes. So there are bits where he and a couple of people who work for him are sort of going to a rehearsal room or a meeting room or something like that, and they just sort of walk down the corridor and they get in a lift, and there's a sort of 15 seconds or so of the door opening and then pressing the button. Like before anyone speaks, and then they sort of walk, you know, they get out and they're sort of walking down the corridor, and like none of this has been filled with dialogue, or like no one's saying anything that pushes the story forward. In lots of cases, no one's saying anything at all. But like, have you written it that way?
Yeah,
or like, you know.
So I would assume not, because I mean, I would be stunned if 22 pages of script included detailed descriptions, because what else is he including there?
Yeah.
You're right. There are moments like even when he finishes recording in the studio, there are shots of someone's hand pressing stop on the control panel and the reels like spinning around and stuff. And I even noticed there's one occasion it really stuck out for me. It was, I think he might be talking to Ringo at the time. But he basically is asked a question, and the camera cuts to Paul to show him give a quick shrug.
Right, yeah.
And
yeah,
then cuts back to the person again. It's like that kind of editing decision doesn't happen in films, right? Like that's it's if you don't have an answer, it's implied by your lack of a response.
Yeah.
And going back to Harry and the character of Harry and his sketchy criminal past, real or not, I think there's a real contradiction around how close is Paul in this film to the real life Paul McCartney outside of this film? Like, is he actually playing himself?
Yeah.
Because I think the level of fame is implied but not shown. Because you have these moments in the film where he has these grand song sequence set pieces.
Mm.
And in particular, it's absolutely incredible futuristic sci-fi space glam rock setup for the song Silly Love Songs.
Yeah.
Which is insane to me.
Yeah.
Which features a body popping dancer who at one point does a double flip backward somersault as cartoon lightning shoots out of his boots.
Yeah.
Very bizarre. But at the same time, you have Paul outside of those moments apparently hiring his own runner by himself in a pub, knowing that that person has a criminal background.
Yeah.
Because he is, and I think Paul is very, very keen to stress this throughout the film, he's a man of the people.
Yeah.
He's very much in touch with the working class, classes.
Yeah.
He just understands them better than the corporate bigwigs that he has to deal with in his celebrity life.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, he's very keen to stress that, isn't he?
To the extent that I still don't understand what his relationship is supposed to be with Giant Haystacks.
No.
When he turns up in the film, it's initially a fantasy that he has where he envisions Harry trying to sell Giant Haystacks the master tapes.
Yeah.
Giant Haystacks, obviously the 80s wrestler.
Yes.
Yeah. Who in this film plays just a very extremely heavy set criminal man.
Yeah. And quite well as well, by the way. He's quite good, Giant Haystacks.
Yeah, he's quite good. He's quite funny. So he has this fantasy where he envisions Harry selling him the master tapes. And the fantasy is so strong that he actually stops the song that they're playing because he says out loud in the microphone, "No, don't." Or stop or something like that, because he's overcome with the feeling of the vision he has of Harry doing this. But then immediately just sidles up to Giant Haystacks and starts saying, "So have you seen Harry these days?" And he's like, "Oh, which one? Harry in the Golden Horn or whatever it is, or Harry Krishna?" Right. He's like, "No, yeah. Harry Torrington, the guy who works for me."
Mm.
And Giant Haystacks says, "Oh, that guy." It's like, how do you know each other? How do you know each other? Like, does Giant Haystacks have a criminal background in this? Like it just the mind boggles as to what that character is supposed to represent, what his relationship with DePaul is, how he might know Harry. It's just a weird moment of characterization that appears out of nowhere and just disappears again without a. Well, I say disappears again without any sort of like signal, but it actually his entire moment in the film ends with him holding up someone by the scruff of his neck off the ground whilst loudly growling
until
the camera cuts away from him.
Is that the last we see of Giant Haystack?
I think that's the last we see of him.
That question of is Paul playing himself or not, or is he playing a fantasy version of himself? And like, if you are Paul McCartney, what is your fantasy of what you are like look like?
Yes.
When your life is most people's fantasy life.
Yeah.
You know, it's a really odd thing. So you can see little bits in it where there's a bit where he's just like walking out of his rehearsal, like they're having a break. And this album where the master tapes have gone missing, his manager, Steve, comes in and says, advance orders for the album have topped 5 million. And so I looked it up, and that would make it like the fastest selling like that album in terms of like pre-sales of all time by a factor of about 4.
Right.
So at this point, so to give it some context, Beatles for Sale had 750,000 pre-orders. It was then overtaken by Super Trooper by ABBA with 1 million. Then Welcome to the Pleasure Dome, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, 1.1 million. Then later on, Be Here Now had like more or less 1.5 million.
So
by this point, at this point, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, I suppose, 1.1 million would have been, that's the most pre-sales anyone's had. And in Paul's mind, which by the way, he will know these figures.
Yes, no, absolutely. He's very commercially minded.
And it's not like he's, when he writes that, he must be aware that this fantasy version of him is being told, oh yeah, you're this album for which we've lost the tapes and you don't seem too bothered about it.
Yeah,
it has like smashed, you know, and even just recontextualized what it is, what pre-sales even are. You know, this is absurd, and he just goes, all right, yeah. Good. Yeah.
So that is the fantasy that Paul McCartney has about what the person he would like to be. Like in his dreams, yeah. He'd like to be the person who does that because it's not enough,
right,
to be the Paul McCartney he already is.
Yeah, but the contradiction in it is that the life he the character leads in it is a relatively unstarry one.
Yeah,
like he has a lot of. You know, he has a lot of sort of money and stuff. You can see that he can afford sort of nice cars and things like that. And he's being sort of chauffeur driven and whatnot. But generally speaking, this seems to be his fantasy version of himself, where like I sell even more records than I do now. but I'm still a normal guy, even more of a normal guy than I actually am in real life, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, because he does do things like turns up at the pub where Harry was last seen, just sort of drives himself there, goes to this pub, goes upstairs to where the landlord lives, you know.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Which the pub, which, by the way, is called The Old Justice.
Yes. It's just one of those distracting things where you think, pubs aren't called that. Like...
yeah, sorry, go on.
No, it's...
just where else do you go? Yeah, that's a really good point. I love the idea of, like... It's like saying I'm rich beyond your wildest dreams. I have $2 billion in the bank. What's your greatest dream? To have $2.4 billion, you know?
Like... and a car with flames up the side.
One thing I did want to touch on was, hey, Ringo's in this.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a proper. Creative product that actually has a Beatle reunion. Just albeit one that isn't really at the heart of it.
No. You know,
it feels like it's the kind of thing where now, I feel like nowadays, you'd only let that happen if it was the point of the film or it was a bigger thing, bigger part of the film.
Yeah.
But Ringo just kind of seems to be in it and isn't even like... the second most amount of screen time or the third most amount of screen time. Like he's a relatively small character in this.
Yeah, he's not really part of the story so much.
Certainly not.
He's drumming in Paul's band, you know, in some of the sessions that are being played.
Mm.
And there are sort of fantasy sequences in which... You know, so Ringo spends a lot of time trying to get off with a journalist who has come to interview him. He's played by Barbara Bach, who is his wife in real life. Which is just really charming in and of itself. Just
it's
like...
charming of itself, but it's also where Ringo is using lines on his own wife. Okay, yeah. which is charming that she's that they've been cast in that way.
Yeah,
but he's a sleazy character. Like it's not like the relationship that evolves for the two of them. I mean, evolves. Even that is politely putting it right. But he basically says, why don't you come to my house and listen to the tapes, right? He's very, very, very quickly, I want to get you back to my place.
Yeah.
So the charming part sort of slips a bit for me there when he sees her and immediately is like, I want to crack on with her.
Yes. Yeah. And so there are bits in it as well where, and I forget whether this is happening in the actual story, which is... in itself a story within a story, but let's leave that aside for
right, yeah.
So is it happening within the actual story or is it happening in one of the fantasy sequences? So there are fantasy sequences in which Paul and Linda and Ringo and Barbara are sort of off in a sort of, I'm going to say it's sort of like Regency costume or Victorian or something like that.
Yeah.
It's sort of general period drama garb and sort of in a with a horse and carriage and all this kind of stuff, you know. And there are bits where they seem to be going on double dates as well. And actually, one of the things it raises is... So Linda is in this and she is the keyboard player in his band and she has a few lines here and there. But I am not sure whether the character of Linda in this is Paul's wife in the story. I'm not sure are they married in the story?
It doesn't explicitly say that they're married. Or but even they are, a couple. I think it's very much implied they are a couple.
I'm not sure, you know.
So they talk about going for dinner and going for dinner with Ringo and Barbara Bach.
Right.
And then it's interesting that they say that early on in the film. And obviously that evening, in quotation marks, the dinner they have is basically like a double date picnic in their Regency costumes.
Yeah.
So I feel like there's a part of that that comes into it, and I think there is probably a little bit of a. It'll be really good to do a bit of a breakdown and proper analysis of that sequence as a dream sequence, because
that's what everyone wants to hear. Isn't it? That's why you've tuned in.
I say it'd be really good for someone else to do that. I have no intention of doing that. But it'll be really interesting to see if there are other elements in the film that play into that, because I do think this idea of them having dinner together is introduced in that sequence as well. There is a moment where he sees her come through all dressed in white on a white horse, and it's very much like she's like the angel of this sort of weird sort of scenario, right, kind of thing. Right. So I think it's implied that there is a she's not just bandmate. So I think it's implied, but absolutely not explicitly stated whatsoever.
Right. Yeah.
But yes. So sorry, going back to the Beatles, commercial angle of this film and the idea that it can be sold as a bit of a Beatles reunion, and also importantly, obviously, that McCartney himself re-records Beatles songs for it.
Yes, yeah, the scenes with Paul and Ringo where they have conversations.
Yeah.
So Ringo is great because he's a good actor in it.
Yeah.
And Paul is, you know, in general has a very sort of detached air throughout the whole thing, and he's quite stiff in general, and so like what the finances were looking for was that sort of like. The chemistry of sort of, sort of Beatle banter, you know, where they just sort of bounce off each other comically as they did in the previous films. There's no particular reason why they shouldn't in this, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Because we sort of talked before a bit about when Ringo has been in films, you know, does he particularly struggle without the other Beatles, you know? And so, yes and no to varying degrees. But Paul, who like in Help and A Hard Day's Night, is great. He's really, really natural. You know, spoke before about, you know, he does a lot of good sort of like close up work and things like that. And you don't think, oh, this guy's a great actor, but you do think, oh, he's pretty capable. You know,
yeah.
And then all of a sudden, so you could be forgiven for thinking, well, especially in his scenes with Ringo, like that kind of thing would just kind of like naturally click into place. And there are scenes in that South Bank Show documentary where it's just him and Ringo on the set, like talking to the director, and they're just sort of mucking about and joking with each other, and that chemistry is there.
Yeah.
And then the camera turns on and it's just gone.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think this very much scripted humour.
Yeah.
That doesn't translate at all. I think I see shades in it sometimes in the anthology series where it feels like Paul trying to force this idea of a deep rooted friendship with actually friends who have become quite estranged over time.
Yeah.
So if it wasn't for that South Bank show, I would say actually they're not that close anymore at this point.
Right.
And actually it's written in a way to imply that they are, but clearly there's no chemistry. But as you say, in that South Bank show, you can see that chemistry is absolutely there.
Yeah.
But Ringo is great in the film. There's a few bits where he has these throwaway moments and lines and stuff. There's actually a really good bit. After there's an extended sequence in the film where they, for some reason, just play three songs in a row as part of their rehearsal with nothing else happening at all. You're literally just watching the band play three songs in a row. And after the first song, which I think is Not Such a Bad Boy, it's almost faint in the background, but you can hear the camera's not on them. The camera's panned away somewhere. You can hear Paul turn around to Ringo and say, that was quite good, that. And Ringo's like, I know. About time you noticed. it's just a really funny line. It's like, and I kind of feel like that probably wasn't scripted. He's just giving a bit back, you know?
Right, yeah. And, that sort of chatter just sort of always came very natural to them when it was the four of them.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it comes very natural to them when it's just like Paul and Ringo having dinner, you know?
Yes, yeah.
But there is something about turning a camera on Paul and saying, act, And I think he is very self-conscious and feeling the pressure of the realization that I have to carry this whole thing. Now, if you think about this, the sort of guy he is, he's very used to being, he likes being the leader of things. He likes being in charge of things. It's not, nothing wrong with that. In most of his creative endeavors, he's absolutely earned that right. And again, it sort of comes back to that question of hubris we were talking about earlier, where he's gone into the medium of film and kind of assumed that he can approach it in the same way. And like, well, I'll be the center of this thing. And that works because that's, you know, it's me. I'm used to being the center of things. But I think he's feeling quite exposed by the acting part of it in particular. I think the way that comes through is that it just gets rid of any of his sort of natural wit or energy, because he's naturally a very funny bloke. You hear him interviewed, like he's very witty and like he's a good sort of mimic and things like that. You know, he's very funny. And all of a sudden when he's acting funny, it's just incredibly stiff all of a sudden. Yeah, and I just think he's feeling that pressure in a way that he probably hasn't done before.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's definitely that is part of it. I think also I feel like he's approaching this as a drama.
Right.
And that deliberately doesn't have, or certainly consciously doesn't have, the same kind of zany humour that his previous movies have had.
Yeah.
Where he can sort of, you know, I guess maybe like a silly sense of humour probably comes quite naturally to him, but this idea of scripted jokes, the odd scripted joke in what is otherwise presented as a drama, is sort of stiffens him a bit. But I think it's fascinating that Ringo's in the film.
Yeah.
It's interesting that he's in the film as Paul McCartney's drummer, which isn't the case at all outside of the film.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that I guess they have agreed that they are presenting this idea that they're in a band together again.
Mm.
It's also interesting to me that the very first time you see Paul and Ringo on screen together is when they're getting ready to perform a song. Ringo's basically saying, "What are we going to do?" And Paul's like, "Oh, it's the medley." And Ringo doesn't seem prepared for whatever that song is.
Yeah.
And just before they start playing, Paul says, no, brushes. Mm. So immediately, Paul's first interaction with Ringo is to tell him how to drum.
His first interaction is like, oh, yeah. So what I'm going to write is like, yeah, the point when we fell out in 1968, yes, the worst we've ever fallen out, and Ringo walked out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll write a scene in which I basically treat him like that again.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just baffling to me. Rather than give Ringo any kind of hero moment for his own musical contribution to these songs, it's very much a Paul show.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what I mean. It's fascinating to me that Ringo is in the film as his drummer in his band, but also that is his only function. He isn't given a showy character at all. He is Paul's drummer, not Ringo Starr.
Yeah.
You know, it's an interesting choice. Like, in some ways, I'm surprised that Ringo agreed to do it.
Yeah, I suppose, because Ringo could be playing Harry, right? You know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That would kind of make sense as a role. Like, he's an earthy guy and he's been in prison and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, Harry, obviously he's missing for a lot of the film, but like you see him a fair bit in flashback. And
definitely,
there are fantasy sequences in which he's sort of being pursued across moors, chased by police dogs holding the tapes and things like that. And you're never quite sure whether that's in Paul's head.
It definitely is. You realise it afterwards, it obviously is, right?
Well, you realise afterwards because of the context, because you don't know where Harry is and this is sort of suggesting where he is. So it is flagged that it is a fantasy of some kind. But also, in what context is Paul imagining this? Because Harry is also in these sequences of sort of Victorian streets, sort of Jack the Ripper kind of thing, where Harry's like running with the tapes, which are now sort of glowing blue, like the Tesseract in the Avengers films,
yes,
for some reason, and like Harry is, like I say, missing a lot, but he is probably a big enough role and a crucial role that Ringo could have played that, you know. And actually, yeah, it's interesting that they didn't go down that route, because it would be a greater tribute to the fact that, like, well, you know, we're in this film together again, and we're both Beatles. But also, this guy is the best actor out of the Beatles, and like, I'm acknowledging that by giving him like a proper part.
Yeah, you know? I do feel like Paul is more interested in getting the group dynamic right than he is about getting the characters in the film right.
Yeah,
you know, it's I mean, we should talk about it as well. So again, very interesting that for this film, Paul decides to re-record new versions of some of his old Beatles songs and some of his Wings and the solo songs as well. But I think a real standout element of this movie is that he's re-recording Yesterday for No One. Eleanor Rigby was the other one I was thinking of. And there's other versions of Long and Winding Road as well, isn't there? And obviously Good Day Sunshine, you said.
Yes, that's right.
I think those are the ones. But it's also interesting that, or am I right in thinking this, or am I wrong? Like, Ringo doesn't play the drums on any of those songs.
I don't think so. Does he play a bit on? No, he plays on Wanderlust.
Yeah. So the idea of getting the brushes was for Ringo to get the brushes for Yesterday.
Right. Yeah.
But he actually doesn't actually get his sticks out until Paul goes into Wanderlust, I think.
I'm not sure. I forget the way it goes.
I think that's right, because I don't think there are any actual proper drumming happening in Yesterday. But I could be wrong. Could be misremembering. But in the South Bank show, Paul talks specifically about this as well, where Melvin Bragg asks him whether he thinks it's sacrilege to be re-recording the Beatles songs and whether fans will think that way. And he says he doesn't think so. He says they're my songs. You know, I can do them what I like. But yeah. Ringo, he makes a point of saying that Ringo has the opposite stance. He says, I won't re-record these songs. I did drumming on it. It was already great. I'm not going to do it again.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. So I wonder if there was, you know, at what point was that sort of discussion had? How far was the idea explored where they might actually re-record Beatles songs together again, properly, and where it fell apart, or why they decided not to do that?
Yeah. But I think there was a point, and I presume it didn't get very far, where it was at least mooted that George would be in the film as well, George Harrison.
Oh, right.
And I read somewhere that, you know, that he said no, and that was that. But I think, so it sounds like it got as far as him at least being asked, even if informally, that he'd want to be in it. There's an interview with George where he's talking about, what do you think of Give My Regards to Broad Street? You know, and he's not a fan, but also says, I don't think he should have re-recorded Beatles songs.
That's interesting.
I think he should leave them alone in general. Now, like, you know, he and Paul not on particularly good terms in the 80s or even in the 90s, really.
Yeah.
But
I can only imagine how much fun George would have had in a Paul McCartney ego film, you know, because that's what this film is, right?
So, right.
Like,
yeah.
Having George play second fiddle to a movie where it's all about Paul. Just, I don't think he's in that place.
No.
At this time.
No, probably not. And yeah, you can't, I mean, you know, the Beatle who comes out of this film the best is George.
Absolutely, by virtue of his distance from it.
Right, by far. but should say, the reason I had to quantify it by saying George Harrison is that George Martin is in the film.
Yes,
as well.
That's right. Yes,
and he is acting the part of I'm not sure if he's named as George Martin, but he's the producer on some songs, and you know he's in the control room and he's great. He's very natural. I think, like, he doesn't have loads to do or anything, but he is just being quite natural and incredibly handsome as well.
Yes, like
at that stage of his life, I think he's probably. He's got his studio out in Montserrat by this point, so he's just like very suntanned.
So he would be, he was 60, around 60 at this time.
Yeah,
Or 61, 62, I think.
Yeah.
But that is interesting. There's lots of shots of him doing that medley, because what the film decides to do at that point, as Paul is playing those songs, is use it as an excuse to provide us a bit of a montage of what happens in the control room.
Right.
Which has no relevance to or bearing on the plot at all. Like, I normally, in any other film, if there's a musical interlude or something and there is a montage to be had, it is something that then propels that plot forward. You see other characters do other things, and by the time the songs end, we're in a different situation to where we were in before those songs started.
Yeah.
But this isn't. This is, we're going to show you what the engineers are doing whilst Paul is recording this in a sort of a montage way.
Yeah.
Because we can't just have the camera showing Paul's face the entire time.
Right.
This is just an odd choice.
Yeah.
To do that. I mean, there is an argument as well, you know, that there's a reading of this film where you take at face value that everything that happens in it is in some way a fantasy of Paul's,
yeah.
including having Ringo back in his band as his drummer.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, like, yeah. there's you could give Paul the benefit of the doubt, or the film the benefit of the doubt, and saying that that is part of the reason for Ringo's casting in the movie, and that's why he's there.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you have to at least allow for the idea that some of this was deliberate.
Yes.
You know, some of these were like actual creative choices that he meant rather than just sort of went wrong in some way. So, yeah, no, that's, you know what? It's a nice thought you've had.
Yeah. Thanks.
But it's a really nice thought that that actually he's thinking, oh, you know, I love being in a band with Ringo.
Yeah.
And that's the fantasy that he's having in the film.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a nice way of thinking about it. I mean, it's very charitable. But
yes, it is. Yeah, charitable is the right word. But yeah, I wonder as we talk more about this that whether other things could be argued charitably in that same way if we saw it through a bit of a nicer lens and took it at that face value.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The other thing I was thinking about when watching Paul perform again the Beatles songs was, I wonder why he chose these ones in particular.
Yeah.
And again, I know we keep referring to it, and I cannot stress enough again that everyone listening to this should watch the South Bank episode on YouTube about the making of this, because it is really, really genuinely interesting. But Paul is asked a kind of a similar question, and he basically says that the reason he chose these songs were because they were ones that he were enjoying playing at the time. But also he points out that there, you know, a lot of the songs that are being remembered, a lot of the Beatles songs that people remember are the showy ones. I think he calls out Strawberry Fields Forever and Sgt. Pepper's at the time as being milestones in the Beatles' career.
Yeah.
Whereas a song like For No One, he calls it a B-side.
Yeah.
And he said these are the songs that people forget about, but actually it's a nice melody. And he talks really fondly, actually, about rediscovering these songs from the early parts of their career and stuff. And it's really nice hearing him talk about having recently rediscovered those songs and what they mean to him and how much how highly he thinks of them now.
Yeah.
Now that the dust has settled a lot on the negative feelings associated with some of them. But it's interesting that he calls that out and says that, you know, this is him showcasing a song that people may not remember. But then the others he chose to do are Yesterday and Eleanor Rigby.
Yeah.
And
famously obscure B-sides.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, I think what's more likely to be the case is he has chosen songs that are very much his songs.
Yeah.
They are McCartney songs within the Beatles catalogue that he can sing and perform and I guess feel like they are songs that he owns in a way.
Yeah, so I suppose that there's a couple of different ways to look at that. One is the obvious reading is those were originally kind of like McCartney solo songs almost. So Yesterday was the first song that only one Beatle performed on. I think Eleanor Rigby also, he's the only Beatle performing on it. For No One, I'm not sure, but I think it's mainly him and a piano and an orchestra. So they're songs of which he probably feels he has ownership already. And so you can kind of interpret that as sort of a bit of ego mainly, maybe. Or another reading of it is that John Lennon only died, two or three years ago when this is being shot and when he's deciding which songs to use. Imagine the reaction if he had taken Lennon-McCartney songs that were more sort of Lennon-based or had more Lennon in them, if you like, and redone them. I think that would have gone down a lot worse.
Absolutely, yeah, I see what you mean. In terms of re-recording them, which he was apparently very keen to do for this film, and was keen to re-record everything live as it was being filmed, which automatically meant a re-recording of these songs.
Yeah,
I guess you're right, steering clear of more Lennon-y songs. Makes sense.
Yeah, because I mean, he started playing for the benefit of Mr. Kite in his live set I saw him do it in 2015. I think he started doing it around then, and he got a bit of stick for that, not loads, but a bit of like, hey, that's a John song. What are you doing with it? You know, and you know, he quite reasonably said, well, it's a Lennon McCartney song, mm-hmm. and yes, it was mainly John's. I'm kind of playing it as a tribute to him, just like he plays something as a tribute to George.
Exactly, yeah. You know?
So like, he's certainly playing that in the right spirit. Not that there would be a wrong spirit in which to play it, but you know what I mean. But it's interesting that sort of Lennon fans, even in sort of 2015, were kind of thinking of that as maybe a bit of a land grab.
Yeah, wow.
And so, you know, 30 years before that, if he'd been re-recording more sort of Lennon-based songs, or even the ones where they're sort of much more, you know, sort of generally known to be 50-50 compositions.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think...
He has to be careful there. I mean, he talks about in the South Bank show that they were considering for a while having Hey Jude in the film.
Right.
And again, that is very obviously a Macca song.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're right. I think it's very carefully chosen to be songs that he can directly claim.
Yeah. And I think also that they are songs, the ones he goes for are ones where an orchestra can be put around them, or like was put around them in the original in most cases. Or, you know, or like at least there were some, you know, string or wind instruments.
Yes, yeah. So they lend themselves to the score more.
Yeah, they lend themselves to the score. So he talks in that documentary about, you know, having scored this film, which, and they're talking about this being sort of the first time he scored an entire film. They're sort of discounting the family way. I think probably because, you know, whether it's the official version or not, I think his main contribution to that was to sort of, he wrote the sort of motif. Right. And that George Martin kind of extrapolated it into the score.
Yeah, sure. Whereas this is very much him scoring the whole thing. And he talks again at length. And the interesting thing about the Eleanor Rigby version in this film is that then segues into an 8 or 9 minute score based on Eleanor Rigby that plays over the Regency dream sequence that we spoke about earlier. Now, we should dig into that dream sequence a little bit, not in an analytical way, which I don't think either of us are qualified to do. But I will say straight off the bat that I think the score that he produces there is fantastic.
Yeah,
like the you know, having those motifs come through, and it's very, very sophisticated in a way that surprises me. That still surprises me about McCartney, even though I know how talented he is in that area. But also in a film where the showier musical contributions he makes are like slap bass, you know, it's like so for him to have done like the pop, had the pop sensibility side of the film covered, but also then produced these amazing scores with a whole range of instruments. At one point, it transitions into this romantic feel Spanish guitar solo. Comes back into this dramatic orchestral piece, There's also like a choir, like a choral part that starts singing some of the lyric refrains from the song, but out of sequence.
Yeah.
So there's the odd line here and there and stuff. And it all is quite haunting. It's very, very, very effective. It is a bit of a shame that it is over that dream sequence, which is nuts.
It is, yeah. So let me, like, in terms of the dream sequences.
Oh, I have no. I mean, if you're going to ask me for an interpretation, or even an to talk through what happens, I couldn't tell you. But I mean, we can try.
I'm not going to try and explain what actually happens in the dream sequences. You know, I think the audience. Like, if you're listening to this podcast and you haven't seen Give My Regards to Broad Street, please go and watch it. It is, I was about to say fantastic there, and I suppose that is, that's one.
In the truest sense.
In the truest sense, yeah. But I think an interesting thing about those dream sequences is that they all seem to fit a dramatic archetype or a generic archetype of some kind. So I don't know if you remember when we were talking about Magical Mystery Tour, and we were talking about there are bits in there where you can tell that if you accept that Paul McCartney is mainly the director of Magical Mystery Tour, that he has watched like action films with chase sequences in
them. Yes, I know what you mean, yeah.
And he's watched like French melodrama, you know, melodrama romances, you know, the bit on the beach.
Yes, that's the bit I think of, yeah, because that's very effectively done.
Right, and I don't know how sort of like cine literate he is in general, but it certainly suggests someone who has observed tropes and or genres and knows how to repeat them or has a desire to repeat them in some way. So you think of so part of the fantasy sequence is the costume drama, and then there's also the sort of Victorian scenes that seem to be sort of you know, Jack the Ripper, that kind of thing. And things like the lighting and the way that is done in there, it's obviously not down to him, you know, there's a director and you know, and God knows how many crew working on it, but if you accept that this is Paul McCartney's creative vision, it's interesting that he seems to sort of observe these things and just want to sort of like, oh, I'm making a film, I'll drop in these bits. Like, I've seen films in which that look like this, or this kind of thing happens, so I'll you know, I'll drop these bits in. That's what films are.
Yeah,
you know, I think that's kind of, and I think maybe that gets us slightly closer to how he thinks about projects like this.
Yeah, you know, I think that makes sense. I think that I actually think there's a lot of stuff going on in that dream sequence that deserves some credit.
Yeah,
I think knowing that it is explicitly a dream sequence in the film, as opposed to the other sort of fantasy sequences where you're not quite sure or are a little bit more grounded.
Mm.
This is one that plays like a dream.
Yeah.
And it's some of the, I mean, for 1984, some of the transitions that take place in that sequence. So you see McCartney in his Regency outfit with, you know, long sideburns and coiffed hair and stuff. He sees a horse and carriage go past, and it's got some of the sort of side characters in. It cuts back to him looking at it again, and then this time when you go back to the horse and carriage, he's in the horse and carriage, and it follows him from that point in the horse and carriage. Even when they bring out the MacGuffin, the tapes, the master tapes, and it's glowing blue, that has some kind of symbolic reference in the dream sequence, in a way that dream sequences have. Like, that's a creative decision to present the master tapes in that way within the context of this dream.
Yeah.
As opposed to just someone showing the already relatively bright blue plastic case, right?
Yeah.
And there were moments in there that kind of remind me of things like, you know, like that him looking at the horse carriage and then seeing himself there is almost reminiscent a little bit of the end of 2001 Space Odyssey, where you see Dave Bowman looking at himself in the bed, and then the next thing you know, at the end after the Stargate sequence, and then you see it from his point of view in the bed, and you know, there are artistic choices that are made in that whole set piece that I do think do a good job of being unsettling enough in a way that the film is trying to be at that point.
Yeah.
I think the problem is that it's also trying to convey plot elements that just come across as complete nonsense when it's just mixing genres, it's mixing different elements of the film previously to now. Mm. Like you say, there's like a Jack the Ripper style element, there's these the corporate business type people at the end standing on the steps bearing over Harry's stabbed body on the steps of some sort of government town hall kind of building.
Mm.
When really all he's done is potentially maybe stolen some master tapes, and suddenly it's like, you know, it's a Victorian murder case.
Yeah.
So it's absolutely baffling to me. The whole sequence is baffling. And what really makes it worse for me is that, again, constantly referring back to this South Bank show, but when Paul says in that documentary, we got given, you know, all of this footage back, and I was like, oh, 8 minutes. Oh, you're telling me I've got to score 8 minutes. Right, okay, fine. Like, he's really put out by it. Like, it was a really important 8 minutes that couldn't be edited down to, like, 30 seconds if they wanted to. Because really... really, like, it is all extraneous stuff. There is no need for that whole sequence to be as long as it is, or to even be in the film at all. So, yeah, it's this undue importance as well placed on that sequence in the film, because it feels like a climactic sequence in the film without actually really doing anything climactic for the plot or the rest of the narrative.
But I suppose, like, what is happening in that dream sequence? So it's of course a dream within a dream. You know,
yes, of course, going deep. This is Inception.
It is Inception, and it's. I mean, it's funny you should mention that. Because if you think of the fact that I suppose what's happening in those is that Paul is having a fantasy or a daydream of some kind about, you know, like he. He and his wife and Ringo and his wife are off like having a picnic in Regency costume. But what keeps on breaking through is the sort of glowing, the tape box, like the stolen tapes. Yeah. And it's almost like his subconscious is giving him clues as to where these tapes might be.
Hmm.
And bits of that are going on in Inception, you know. In fact, it's probably safe to say that this entire... would there have been Inception... without Give My Regards to Broad Street. Who's to say? But that seems to be what it is. His subconscious is giving him clues, you know. Mm. And then, you know, towards the end, you know, when Paul figures out what sparks Paul off to sort of finally figure out what has happened to these tapes. And again, you know, you sort of about sort of generic tropes that actually the main genre that the thing is a sort of mystery or a whodunit, or a what done it or a what happened or
what happened.
that's not a thing, is it? What sort of film is it? It's a what happened.
Classic what happened.
Right. Okay. That's sort of most films, isn't it? But. So he, you know, there is a mystery to be solved, you know, and Paul is the detective, you know. He does no detective work whatsoever until the sort of last 15 minutes or so when he kind of starts thinking about it a bit. He goes off to the old Justice pub and he goes and sees the landlord there and asks the landlord, was Harry in the other night? And so, like, this scene is really interesting because so this guy, this landlord is called Jim. And he's played by Ralph Richardson, who is a sort of like old, much venerated British actor. This was the last thing he ever appeared in. He died quite soon after filming the scenes. Mm. I think I'm not sure he even lived to see the film's release, which might have been a mercy, to be honest. But I find it really interesting that this guy who has had this sort of obviously storied career and. The last thing he does is to be in a scene with an obvious non-actor and the scene is really only sort of half written as well. And you think, well, what is an actor like Ralph Richardson thinking about at the time? Because he's great. He's doing really well in it.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's another one of these scenes where just bits in it that don't go anywhere. So Jim says, would you like a cup of tea? And Paul says, no, I'm all right. Like, you know, I'm not going to be along. And then they talk a bit, and then Jim says again, "You sure you don't want a cup of tea?" And Paul goes, "Well, yeah, okay, actually, I will." And like, if you're going to do something like that, there needs to be some significance to it. Like, there needs to be like a reason why he's changed his mind, right? And that needs to convince you of something that Paul. Paul's thinking has shifted at some point in the scene, and he now thinks, yes, actually, I will stay and have a cup of tea because I think this is going somewhere, or whatever.
Yeah,
but there's none of that at all. And it's also that usually, in terms of dramatic structure, this character would be the sort of wise old sage who gives Paul some advice.
Mm.
And he kind of does give him some advice in it. Paul just kind of ignores it. but the point,
I feel like that's also a recurring motif for the production of this whole film, to be honest with you.
Yeah, true. he should be sort of giving him advice, which Paul then goes, right, you know, and that gives him an idea, and it sparks off the third act.
Yes,
I completely agree. Dramatically, that is how a construct like this usually works. You know? Yeah, and it happens a lot. With sort of wise old sage characters,
yeah,
you know, who sort of like suddenly change the protagonist's mind, make them think in a different way, and now they're off towards like solving their crime or whatever it is. But basically, like Paul establishes that Harry was in the pub, and I think also establishes that he has a blue box with him,
yeah.
But then just doesn't press any further. No. Like he's there specifically to find out what happened to Harry and this blue box of tapes. And he finds out there was a blue box and then just sort of leaves it at that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then just leaves.
But they get into very quickly this sort of weird quoting, almost Shakespearean quotes with each other. Oh, and Jim, the landlord, starts saying like, you know, do you want to read? He quotes Leisure. What is this life if you look care, if you have no time to stand and stare?
Yeah.
And then says, I write poetry. Do you want to read some of my poetry? Again, like all of it, just needless.
Yeah, and Paul goes, no, I'm all right.
Yeah.
Like, oh, okay. So there seems to be a bit in it where like the character of Paul should be arriving at some sort of self-realization through this interaction. So like, you know, Jim says to him, you know, like you're always running around. Like, if you didn't run around so much, you might get a better view of the world, is what he says to him. Which, by the way, reminded me of, like, have you ever heard the story of Liam Gallagher meeting Paul backstage at the Royal Albert Hall?
No.
Where, like, and Paul says to him, you're always in such a rush. Sit down. And he says to Liam, do you want a margarita? And Liam says, no, it's all right. I ate before I left. Paul says, I meant a drink, you daft prick. Anyway, but like, I liked the fact that it reminded me of that, like those roles were reversed of someone saying to Paul, like, you're always rushing around, take your time. But the character Paul like doesn't heed this advice at all, or at least he doesn't seem to take it in. He just sort of goes. It's such a good example of like how these scenes are written, where it would take no work at all to sharpen that scene up.
No, absolutely. Yeah, you're right.
Because all of its building blocks are there. And again, it kind of demonstrates, I think, that Paul McCartney has watched films in which the wise old sage talks to the protagonist, sends him off in another direction. But he's kind of only digested half of it. He's sort of digested the surface level of it. And he's just kind of like stuck it in a film.
Yes, yeah.
And it would have been so easy, you know, just to, you know, presumably, you know, if he'd let someone else have a look at the script, maybe someone who'd written a script before.
Yeah.
And they would have said, oh, okay, actually, if you tighten this up a bit and if you make him say this, that will send Paul off and then the third act can kick off, that kind of thing, you know.
But because what actually happens then at that point, because that leads directly into the actual last part of the film where Paul finds Harry.
Mm.
And what actually happens is he drives around a bit and just remembers for the first time that day that Harry said he was going to Broad Street.
Yeah, it was the last thing he said to him.
Yes.
Before, like, you know, the last time he saw Harry, that's what he said.
So obviously, if you were trying to retrace someone's steps, that's where you start.
Yeah.
This is, by the way, possibly one of the best / worst moments in the film where Paul remembers this. And like, I haven't seen anyone remember something so visibly before, because he literally looks up at the sky, and loudly clicks his fingers like you do. Like if you're really making a show of the fact you just remembered something, you know, like, oh, you know, like really, like, that's what I'm doing, right? Reversed.
Right. It reminds me a bit of, I don't know if like, if you've like narrowly missed a bus or a train.
Yes.
And people have seen you like not quite make it, and they're looking at, they're on the train and they're looking at you. And I don't know about you, but I often feel like I have to sort of perform ever so slightly.
Yeah.
Like there's a sort of performative, like, oh, just missed it, like to show that I'm not too annoyed or whatever.
Lee Evans used to have this thing where it's like, you know, when you're walking down the street and you realise that you've forgotten something, you have to go around, but you can't just turn around because people think you're crazy. Yeah. So whenever you do that, you have to be like, oh, I forgot my briefcase. And you have to be really, really performative. Yeah, it's very much like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Even though he's in the car by himself, driving it, so he does that visibly, remembers that Harry said he was going to Broad Street, so then finally decides to check out Broad Street.
Yeah,
this is where No More Lonely Nights kicks in. So what we basically get is lots of somber shots of a lonely single Paul McCartney walking around a very, very empty, deserted London station.
Until
he sits down, does actually what I think is a very effective and probably Paul's best piece of acting in the whole film, a pretty decent double take when he actually spots the master tapes on the bench next to him.
Yeah, which have been on a bench on a train platform for about 24 hours,
so let's dig in. So let's dig into this, right? Okay. Because then what he does is he hears Harry crying, help.
Yep.
And he discovers Harry locked in a sort of janitor's room or whatever. Yeah. He, to say kicks the door down is generous, because he kind of lightly taps it with his foot and it swings wide open.
Yeah.
Only for Harry to be like, oh, it locks from the outside. I've been stuck in here all night and all morning. And then I fell asleep and it's cold and it's dark. And I thought this was a toilet.
Yeah.
Giving 8 excuses in one go.
And then
they just fall about laughing and all is forgiven and the day is saved. Not that Paul is annoyed that Harry has taken his master tapes to the station and, needing to go to the toilet, has decided to leave those abandoned on a bench in order to then go and try and find a toilet and then get locked on it.
Yeah, the master tapes of the album that has like 4 times more pre-sales than any other album in history.
So even if Harry was correct and had found a toilet, he'd still very much put those master tapes at risk. That is enough for me for Paul to fire him, you know. Like it just is out of negligence,
right?
Rather than any kind of criminal intent.
I suppose, like, to be fair, like, you know, everyone else in the film has been saying, oh no, we think he's probably a crook, he's probably stolen them.
He's not, he's just an idiot.
Right, yeah. But like exceptionally negative. like in a way that just kind of vindicates everyone else, not thinking he's a crook, but certainly thinking this guy should not work for
you. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
He's really irresponsible.
What I meant. When I said he was a criminal and a thief, what I actually meant was that he was just dodgy. But dodgy in a different way. Dodgy in a way that meant he's inept. So yeah, it's a bizarre ending. Then he phones up Linda and says, look, guess what I found the tape. Linda, who by the way is in a very luxurious drawing room with Ringo and Barbara back, they immediately start popping champagne and stuff like that, because they are very much of a sort of rich elite class at this point in the film for some reason.
But we should point out the order of events. So by the way, what is happening is that the reason they need these master tapes so badly is that if they don't get them back in time, I suppose we could be forgiven for sort of not mentioning this, even though it's the sort of main driving tension of the entire thing, because it's not particularly tense.
Because you use two words there that don't exist, driving and tension.
No, that is true. Yeah. No, they don't. They really don't apply to this situation
really at all.
But what's happening is almost like a similar scenario to like the end of Brewster's Millions, where like this thing has to happen by midnight. At the stroke of midnight, Paul's company will be signed over
to Rathbone Industries.
Yeah. And Mr. Rath, who wears sunglasses and is therefore evil.
Yep.
And his driver/minder is played by Frank Burnside from The Bill.
Oh, is he?
Yeah. Christopher Ellison.
Yes, it is. Yeah. I remember thinking that. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
But what's happening there is that, so at this point, it is about 5 to midnight. Mm-hmm. Paul's company will be in ruins. Like, I think, like, financially, he will be ruined by this.
Yes. Yeah.
If in, like, in 5 minutes...
Not that there's
minutes,
really been any sense of that peril at all.
No. He doesn't come across as a man imperiled.
No. Like,
but once he discovers the tapes, he and Harry sort of, like, run down the station steps, having a bit of a laugh. Paul, like, chucks the tapes to Harry.
Yeah.
In a way to, hey, here we go, catch. You know, yeah, like, it's a big laugh. And so they haven't... obviously, there are no mobile phones, but, like, the first thing you do is call the office and say, hold everything, don't sign that contract, I've got the tapes. He doesn't do that. He calls his wife.
Yeah.
Who, you know, and tells her, and then does he say to her, oh, can you tell the office?
Yes, exactly, forward it on.
Right, and yeah, she's like, all right, yeah, but I mean, me and Ringo will just get drunk for a bit first. then maybe we'll give him a ring, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know, it's just, that whole thing is, it just points to there is a lack of urgency about the entire thing.
Yeah.
I suppose that the stakes I described there are sort of implied ones, really, that this is going to ruin him financially.
Yes,
you sort of have to piece this together yourself. And I suppose, like, there are people saying what is going to happen, but that is not sort of dramatically forced through in any sense. You're not aware of how serious this is going to be, really.
And I think one of the things, I mean, I think that's part of it. The sense of the stakes involved aren't apparent at all in the film. But it's almost a doubly inadequate ending because the actual resolution comes with this sense of, God, what am I like, eh? Oh, I accidentally got trapped in a cupboard. That was the whole thing. Yeah. And it was just this sense of, like, it's just a bit of silly, nothing really mattered, did it really? You know, yeah, it's just, you know, just this playful sense of silliness that caused the whole thing, and all is forgiven and all is well.
Yeah.
So if there were any sense of stakes, then that would undermine them. But as it is, it undermines nothing to begin with, and it just ends up feeling like it's all been a waste of time, which is, to be fair, bang on.
Yeah, it's true. You know, and I mean, if the film is a waste of time, then recording a podcast about the film
for an hour and a half.
I mean, what does this say about us?
This is now probably a good time to say, do you agree? Have we wasted our life? Have you watched a film and feel like you've wasted your life? We'd love to know. Please get in touch with us on all the usual social media platforms. We are at Beatles Films Pod. We'd love to hear from you if you've seen the film and if there are any redeeming qualities at all that you think we may have missed, or if you just want to chime in with more rinsing of the movie and any other points we may have overlooked. Also, while I have you, why not leave us a review? If you've enjoyed listening to this episode or listened to any other episodes and enjoyed those, it would be great if you could write us a review or even leave us a 5-star rating on your podcast listening platform of choice. That would be very much appreciated. Otherwise, we're back now, so we will see you again next week for another episode. And until then, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight.
and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.